welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews. You can catch our past programs on archives.org/bookmark/SGL. And today we have Rethinking Immigration. Eric Vega presented Rethinking Immigration. He is a professor of Chicano Studies at California State University at Sacramento, and he spoke to the Sacramento United Nations Association on June 23, 2008. Professor Vega has a law degree from the New College School of Law in San Francisco. He's taught at the Sacramento State College for the last 15 years, and he has been the executive director of the Sacramento Human Rights and Fair Housing Commission, as well as an attorney for the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund. Here is Professor Eric Vega.
I kind of was introduced to this issue years ago when speaking to a group of migrant workers. One of them said, "Can I talk to you, Mr. Vega? I don't know what to do. My employer keeps 30% of my paycheck. He says he has a little black box that will keep the migra away." I said, "What?" "My employer says he has a little box that will keep the migra away." "What is the migra?" "Well, anybody know immigration, right?" So, I called up the sheriff. I said, "There's a man having money extorted from him. What should we do?" And he says, "Don't worry, we'll come out and arrest that illegal." What? And then a woman went to her priest complaining, I got together with this man and we started living with each other, but now he's become abusive. And I don't know what to do because I'm undocumented. And he says that if I complain or I talk to anybody, he's going to drop a dime on me. I mean, he's going to call up the INS. What do I do? So fortunately in that case, the priest became involved and put some knuckles and some pressure on the guy, let go. But what I'm trying to define right now for you is how this impacts people's lives real specifically, right? And another example of this was I was speaking to migrant workers in Yolo County, and the man had died in Mexico. The family was still in the United States, and so they talked about it a little bit. And here's the deal. He didn't get proper training on the use of pesticides. Everybody know what I'm talking about right now. The dust that you may distribute in the fields in Yolo County, really important agricultural community. And he didn't use a mask. He didn't use gloves, and so it got into his system. And what happened in his case is that his circulatory system began to melt. And what happened in his case and in other cases was that when he started getting really sick, he said, "Patron or boss, what do I got to do?" And he goes, "Look, I'll give you a couple $100. Why don't you go back to Mexico with your family and take care of your illness?" And so he melted away in Mexico, right? I went in to see my mother, was the director of a center in Yolo County that took care of little kids, the children of farm workers. Does everybody know what I'm talking about? So there's 30 children in the room. They're little babies. They're little kids. And I came in. "Hey, Mom. How are you?" "Oh, fine, honey. What? Oh, I just wanted to say hi." And I look at the kids, and there's flushed cheeks and glassy eyes and what's obvious elevated temperature levels and sniffly noses, and they're all sick. And I went over to my mother. I said, "Mom, what's wrong with these people? They're not taking their kids to the doctor." And she gave me one of those looks, like her eyes kind of, "You get your ass out of here. I'll talk to you later." Uh-oh. Whoop, 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 whoop. I went home, and I said, "Mom, what did I say? What's the problem?" She said, "Don't you ever say something like that again. These people love their children. Many of these people are undocumented. This is a county that is controlled by the growers. They hear when doctors start telling them that there are lots of the farm workers complaining about their children being sick. It is most likely a fact of life for undocumented workers in the fields that you have aerial spraying that drifts into the water supply line and causes many children to get sick. It's a fact of life. These people love their children, and they believe that they can take care of them better and watch them and nurture them better but they can't afford to lose a job. So those were the kinds of things that I saw personally that prompted me to get a little bit excited and want to... there was one other thing. I became involved in the 187 campaign. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that, but in California, Proposition 187 was put on the ballot. The people wanted to have the issue of immigration examined, and they wanted to send a message. It was called SOS, Save Our State. And when I heard, or rather, when I read one of the speeches of one of the leaders, what they said to their audience was, you are the posse, 187 is the noose. And I went, oh my God, what are we looking at here? What are we talking about here? Because this was an initiative before the people of the state of California that would do what? In substantial form, what it said is we're going to take away medicine from children and we're going to kick them out of the schools. Does everybody understand what I've said right now? And did the people of California vote in favor of that? Yes, they did. Now, I'm very proud because that motivated me. I got out into the streets. I made a ruckus with a number of students, mechistas, Chicanos, young Mexican-Americans. And in the city of Sacramento, we were able to defeat it. But it was very scary to see substantial numbers of people respond to the rhetoric that was prevalent at that time against undocumented people. So, I wanted to talk a tiny bit about some statistics, first give you a little bit of context. According to the UN, there are approximately 190 million international migrants in the world today. And the way that was broken down to me is that it's approximately 3% of the population of the world. And they send home approximately $300 to $500 billion a year home. One example of that, one estimate, is that 2 years ago, primarily Mexicans in the United States were sending back something like $20 billion to Mexico. So around the world, the remittances, meaning workers from Mexico who come to the United States as an example, send home money that they make out after they've worked in the fields, as an example. They send money back home to Irapuato, right, to Sinaloa, to Guadalajara. Hey, Glenn. Hey, Mary. They send money home. So that's a really interesting phenomenon that I hope you will take a look at. There are approximately 12 million refugees. There's an estimated internally displaced peoples of about 26 million. So just for the record, so what we're talking about here includes people like in Afghanistan and Iraq that have been displaced by wars, right? That's what we're talking about. There are a lot of millions of people that are displaced by these wars. In 1890, the foreign-born population in this country, so now I'm shifting over to the United States, constituted about 14.8% of the population. Today, they are moving in that direction, but they are still about roughly between 12.5 and 13% of the population. So I think it's still a little bit under the high point of the early 1900s.
Is that the number of people who have immigrated from another country?
Yes. So foreign-born, people who were born in another country and have come to this country. And they are approximately 16% of the labor force. In 2006, over 1.2 million obtained permanent legal residency. So I'm not going to go through the various categories. I mean, this is an area that is both complex and emotional, but I can't go through all the stuff. So suffice to say that there's this category that basically says they are legal in this country, permanent legal residents. There has been a dramatic increase in naturalization since 1976. Let me just stop you for one minute. Why do you think that there may have been a really dramatic increase in the number of people wanting to legalize their status and become citizens of the United States over the last 10 years? Why would you think that would be true, based on what I've just told you? Glenn, you know. Why has there been a really spike in the number of people that are saying, I want to become a citizen and a vote?
Or perhaps it's because of NAFTA?
Well, it's because of 187 that I was just describing to you, and NAFTA, and a number of different reasons. But what I'm talking about here is the message that many of these people are getting is that they are under the gun. They work hard, they're trying to take care of their families, and people are looking at them and marking them with an immigration illegal on their forehead, so to speak, right? They're being looked at, they're being monitored, and they're being hurt, right? And so they say, well, this is a real good reason to legalize my status. And you know what? When I get a chance, I will vote. I will remember how people treated me. Yeah. So I think I want to emphasize that there is some dramatic things happening in terms of the voting population stemming from their feelings as immigrants in this country. Some of the top countries I'll just mention would include Mexico, China, Philippines, India, and Cuba. The undocumented population is just roughly around 12 million people. We don't know for sure. So some rabid advocates on the right will say that it is 20 million, and I can't tell you that they are wrong. But most of the established research would indicate it's roughly in the area of 12 million people. In this country, immigration laws right now are being enforced by the Department of Homeland Security and by extension, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which go under the acronyms DHA, but for purposes of raids, which we are in that period of time, a period of raids, ICE. ICE is the acronym that is associated. If you see on the news tomorrow that there was a raid in Sacramento, you will see the acronym ICE, and it's been happening all around the country. There has been a substantial increase in the budgets for the Border Patrol and a very dramatic increase in the number of Border Patrol officers. So under this administration, you're seeing a dramatic increase in an enforcement mentality, how you deal with the question of immigration into this country. There has been approximately 5,000 recovered bodies since 1994. So here's the deal. During the Clinton administration, Clinton was very nervous about the right wing gaining politically in this country, and he needed to triangulate, I think is the word that was used quite often. He needed to figure out a way of Democrats sounding tough, and so he said, let's militarize the border. Let's have Operation Gatekeeper. Let's figure out a way to close down the border so that we stop these people from coming into the country. And the public will support Democrats when you show that you're tough, right? So the stat that I gave you is that there have been lots and lots of people, thousands of people that have been dying in the deserts. Now, we are not clear. We don't really know how many people have died. This is an interesting issue. If you've ever heard of border angels, these are people that are going out into the desert to provide water for people who are walking through the deserts in between California and Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, and did I get those right? California, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas. Yep. So there has been a 400% increase in detentions since 1994. In October of 2007, there were about 15,000 immigrants in detention facilities around the country. So growing like mushrooms, or perhaps even faster, are detention facilities. If any of you have ever heard of Halliburton, you may know that the privatization of law enforcement is increasingly a phenomenon of our United States. We know about it in terms of foreign wars, but it is also happening in the United States by way of a privatized jail system or detention center system in the United States. One of the scandals that is associated with that is non-compliance with basic human standards. And what we're talking about is people are dying in these detention centers, and they basically are seen as not having any rights. So you probably haven't heard too much of it, although it has been in the papers. But this is very much a scandal that is being analyzed on a daily basis. Yesterday in the newspaper, the University of Syracuse published a report in which they said that there's been a surge in federal prosecutions. So federal criminal prosecutions, the majority, 57%, are now against immigrants. This is criminal prosecutions against immigrants. Now, you may know that historically, immigration violations were seen as basically civil infractions. So under this administration, you've seen a dramatic emphasis on criminalizing the undocumented status. And next would be narcotics prosecutions at 13%. So I thought that was kind of fascinating. There's a real strong emphasis right now by this administration to send a message, we are going to be tough on those people that are crossing illegally into the country. So the administration is pursuing a broad, high-profile raid strategy. And over the last year, it's estimated that some 4,000 people have been snatched in this country. Now, this includes going into meatpacking factories and doing the old-fashioned raids where a bunch of cars and buses show up and you actually raid the whole place. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. I wanted to touch right now on just very quickly, why do we have this immigration phenomena, this movement of people across the planet Earth in the 21st century? One theory is often referred to as push-pull theory. And one sentence, it just means that people in a poor country say, I've got muscles, I've got a brain, I can cross the border and I can make some money, right? And there's not enough jobs over here for me to make a living, so I'm going to go up there. And over there, the over there is saying, we would like to have a lot of people because we have jobs that are not being filled. So push-pull theory. Another theory that I'll just touch on in one sentence is world systems theory. And I think what this attempts to... It's a little bit more nuanced, I think, than push-pull. It says there are structural factors on the planet Earth that lead to some nations with advanced capitalist economies. Their people want servants. Yes? So the rich countries who watch TV want servants. And there's lots of servants out there. Okay? What I wanted to do is try to summarize two things. One is that we are living in a very interesting period of time of transnationalism, in which lots of people are moving around because they want to feed their family. That's what's happening. It's happening in Europe. I just got back from Europe just a week ago. And it's interesting because I'll tell you about the European Union, but there's also significant numbers of African people that are drowning in the Mediterranean. I think the figure is just roughly around 649 in a year or something like that. I mean, so instead of a desert, there's the Mediterranean Sea. Now, having said that, some very interesting things are happening in the European Union in terms of moving across borders. So we're living in this period of transnationalism, and we're seeing poor workers offering themselves up on the world market. Indeed, it's kind of interesting. One thing I just read the other day is that approximately 10% of Filipino workers are putting themselves out into the world market. And the Philippines recognizes that it may not have a lot of things that it can export, but it does have a lot of people that it can export. In other words, seeing your people as a form of economic development, right? Because they're going to be sending money home because the contracts that they will have may benefit the nation of the Philippines. And two, we're in the period of time in which we have to look ourselves in the mirror regarding the old paradigm, which pits citizenship against aliens, right? So historically, all of us in this room would probably say, it's a good thing to be a citizen of the United States. If you get caught someplace else, you want to say, and by the way, here's my passport, I'm a citizen of the United States. And in this country, you assert your civil rights. I will sue you in court because I'm a citizen of the United States. I have my rights under the law, right? So what's happening around the planet Earth is that more and more displaced workers are being put into the category of being aliens. Where what? Where they lose rights. Where they are popularly perceived as being lesser peoples than who? Than citizens. And citizens, of course, kind of like that. I'm a privileged person. I kind of like being a citizen. I'm not an alien. Everybody with me? So there's something interesting that is occurring on the planet right now. Lots of displaced workers offering themselves up, more and more and more of them, and this paradigm, which is kind of founded on this distinction between national citizenship and those aliens. And of course, what I'm getting at right here is when you are an illegal alien, it's easier to take advantage of you, right? I mean, when you get right down to it, you can make more money off them, right? That's kind of the crass way of thinking about it. Okay, so what I wanted to do is take you through a little bit of immigration law and policy. So I just put together some notes there, and I'm going to go through it fairly quickly, but I just wanted to tell you a little bit about our own history regarding immigration. It's not a pretty story, and like South Africa and Australia, when you examine immigration law and policy, you kind of start getting, oh my God, we were a white settler state. I mean, basically, until not too long ago, until a fairly short period of time ago, we had very troubling policies. The kind of the general review, if you were looking at the history of immigration law and policy, would go something like this. There was an open door period, in other words, during the colonial period. It's just basically, come on over here, it's just Indians over here, please come over. You know, it's dark over here, and we'll give you a shovel, we'll give you some land. Come over here, open door. And then you begin to see some regulation. And initially it's at the local level. The harbor master says, you, come on, you know, get off the boat, you, whoop. No village idiots, you, whoop. Cough again, nope, you stand up. But it was local regulation. And then as a period of time goes by, the United States government actually formally becomes involved and begins to regulate in the area. It says, we are going to have essentially plenary power or overall regulatory power in this issue of immigration, of who's coming into the country. Yes? And then we went through a period of restriction that I will talk about in just a moment. And finally, in 1965, there was an Immigration Act that opened us up, that kind of repudiated some of the kind of racist underpinnings of our immigration policies and opened us up to the rest of the world. And then I would finish off by saying that we are in the restriction period, a new restriction period. So I'm going to go back in time here. And, no, oh, just one other thing. You know, there were large groups of people that came from other parts of the world, but we cannot say that they formally came in as immigrants. So what I'm talking about is one of the largest movements of people on the planet Earth took place because the young people that were wanting to make a lot of money in the plantation system of the New World, the problem that they had was that the indigenous people died. Like when you coughed, you're a European. When you cough, Indian people would die. Their immunological systems weren't prepared to deal with Europeans. Yes? And so your cheap labor force that you'd like to have, you know, picking the cotton, they're dying off, or they live in their own nation so they can run away to their village. So there you have what happens is the importation of African farm workers. That's another way of thinking about it. The importation of African farm workers to come over here into the plantation system. You may not know this, but we actually, in the United States, actually got a fairly small number. The majority of those peoples went into the Caribbean and into places like Brazil. So if you visit this summer, you go to the Caribbean or into various parts of South America, you're going to see a very different racial configuration, because what happened in British North America, which is where we're at, in British North America, there was not this profound mixing that turned into mestizaje, the mestizos of you know, Mexico and Central America, South America. You didn't really see that happen in any profound way in British North America. So African labor being brought in. And I do want to say just generally that for a period of time, labor from Asia was coming in just roughly as an outgrowth of the 1840s and 50s period in the West Coast, in particular the Western states. But they faced a violent reaction that a lot of people don't know about. So I'll touch on that in just a minute. Okay. 1790 Naturalization Act. So naturalization means you're born in another country, but you can follow certain rules that will allow you to become a citizen of the United States. So in 1790, one of the first laws passed by the Congress, they say, We only want you to be a naturalized citizen if you're a free white person. So everybody see that there's, from a very early stage, there's going to be this kind of problem that is going to happen for lots of people. Not ironically, but just it's interesting to note that the people that were most dramatically impacted by the 1790 Act were Asian immigrants, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a moment. In 1882, organized labor in particular was at the forefront of pushing, of really pushing, we got to get the Chinese out of here. Now, what they were trying to say is we want Asian people out of here, but they could only formulate it in terms of Chinese, get the Chinese out of here. And so I want you to know, if you don't know, that historically in this country, the kind of the framework of seeing kind of racist violence is to see the Ku Klux Klan, you know, hanging a black person. But I want to be clear, Asian immigrants in this country suffered profound, really big violence towards them. In California, in Mariposa County, you know, the banner went up, whipped them if you see them after dark. The California Constitution was amended to say, you know, we will not hire them. Is it Olympia in the state of Washington? Drive them out of town. In Wyoming, I think it's approximately 19 are murdered. Of a Saturday night, you get liquored up and you go and beat up some of those Chinese, or you burn down some of their stuff. It was very, very ugly and violent. Oh, no, what I was saying is that in 1790, the Congress passes a law saying, if you want to become a naturalized citizen, you need to be a free white person. And the amendment to that was the people that was going to be particularly impacted by that were Asians later on. So they come in later, but they're the ones that are going to be particularly impacted by that. So there you have Chinese Exclusion Act. The basic idea, I mean, if you look at some of the primary sources from that period of time, what labor union guys are saying is this is white man's country. Why do we have this? Why do we have Asians here? This doesn't make any sense. So kick out coolie labor, as it was referred to. In 1917 and that period of time, you saw attempts to create literacy tests and head taxes on immigrants coming into the country. The agricultural and business lobby basically went into Congress and said, you don't mean Mexicans, do you? And so they amended it to make sure that that did not mean Mexicans, because the agricultural and business community needed what? Cheap labor that was not going to be hindered by old laws that tell you got to learn how to speak English, etc. The really kind of interesting stuff happens in the early 20s, and I put quotas and national origin. Primary sources from that period of time say we're concerned about the mongrelization of the Anglo-Saxon race. Here's what I'm talking about. If you've ever seen the movie The Godfather, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, right? Little Vito Corleone is coming in to New York Harbor. Well, on the street, people were pissed. They were saying, we don't want those non-English speaking. They smell, they beat their women, they're liquored up, they're like the Irish. If I didn't tell you, the Irish were subject to a great deal of hostility. I mean, they were throwing rocks at them as they're trying to come off the boats. They were burning down the parishes of Irish people. It was very, very ugly towards the Irish. But I'm speaking now of Southern and Eastern European peoples who were coming in, right? The IQ test is developed out of the tests in Ellis Island, right? And one of the things that they're saying is, you know, George, when you give one of those tests to the Hungarians, well, they're dumb as stone. Give to an English person, they do really well. Anybody have an idea why the Hungarian might do differently? They didn't speak English, right? Everybody with me? But Polak jokes come about from this period of time. The idea that Eastern Europeans and Southern European people are dumb butts comes about as a result of some of these things that are happening during that period of time. What does that mean, quotas of national origin? If you want to try to preserve the Anglo-Saxon profile of this country, you want to limit people from Southern Europe and Eastern Europe. So that's what that legislation is about. It's about saying, we are going to try to look at census data and say, if Englishmen were 80% of the population in 1880, that's the percentage that we should have in 1930. Does everybody see what I'm saying? It was an attempt to create a profile in which you are emphasizing Northwestern European people, not Africans, not peoples from other parts of the world, and if as much as possible, even keep the Eastern Europeans and Southern Europeans out as well. The Supreme Court had a field day with what are sometimes referred to as the racial restriction cases. And so the two that I'll mention here are Ozawa and Thind. All this means is the courts were trying to figure out, what does it mean to be a white person? I mean, nobody could figure it out for sure. What does that mean? Because it had real consequences in the world. So Ozawa from Japan says, look at me, I'm a Boy Scout. I'm every possible thing you can possibly, you know, I should be okay. No, you're not Caucasian. And then Thind says, well, actually, I'm from the area that you think of as India, but my family is what you might call Caucasian. Do you know what I'm talking about? Which is a part of the eastern portion of Europe. Well, I'm actually coming from Caucasian. And so, they're scratching their heads. What we really mean is, what does the common man on the street think Caucasian is? And you don't fit the bill, right? So that's what's happening in those racial restriction cases. In the 1930s, there's a depression. And so there's a massive attempt to deport as many of those people as possible. So you see the emergence of the Border Patrol and the repatriation campaigns is send them Mexicans back. So it's approximately 600,000. Philippines repatriation. As you may know, we became an empire, the United States, approximately 1898 as a result of the Spanish-American War. So we acquired Cuba and Puerto Rico and Philippines, right, from Spain. We got it. The people came with it. Now, the problem is that if it's part of the United States, then they don't have to worry about restrictive immigration laws. So you saw a number of Filipino people coming over to the United States. Now, that infuriated lots of people. So they said, what are we going to do to stop them from coming over here? And they said, well, we'll allow them to become an independent nation, and then we can apply our restrictive immigration laws. 1940s, is Japanese internment. So the numbers are approximately just roughly around 115,000, something like that. These are immigrants, and most of them, if I remember correctly, are U.S. citizens. Yes? Put in detention camps. Yes? Masako. Masako. My aunt was there. Yes? In the 1940s, going all the way to 1965, was the Bracero program. So I just want to do this little roller coaster trip with you. In the 1930s, kick them out. In the 1940s, we love you, Bracero Mexican boys. Come over here. We need you because our boys are fighting a war. There's lots of jobs, so we'll have to have our women go into the factories and we'll bring in Mexicans to do contract labor. So it's known as the Bracero program. I think the number, what is the number there? I've lost my place. 5 million people. In the 1950s, however, this country really likes law enforcement. Break out the whip. You know, I mean, just come on, put your hat on, pull out your guns, and you do the right thing. Right? So Operation Wetback is a program that the INS is pursuing during that period of time. It's like, really show the people of America that we're going to be tough with these illegal aliens. Now, we move to 1965, and what's happening in the 1960s? It's the civil rights era. Yeah? The civil rights era. And the United States is being embarrassed on the world stage because the Soviet Union and communist ideology is able to go to people of color around the world and say, why in the world do you want to go and be with the United States? They don't like people who look like you. We stand for the national liberation of people of color all around the world. We are with you against colonialism. Why? Just look at how they discriminate against black people. Everybody with me? That's what's happening on the world stage. So, and they could also say, and look at their immigration laws. They're stone cold racist over there. Why on earth would you want to align yourself with the United States? So, in 1965, you see this major reform take place in immigration law. Here's the basic idea. Congress repudiated national origins and quotas that had emphasized Northwestern Europeans and now said, we're going to open up to the rest of the world and be diverse. And people from Latin America, from Africa, from Asia, we welcome you in. What our concern is going to be is family unification and making sure that we take care of our labor needs here in the United States. I want you to know that that's 1965. From that period of time, the modern conservative movement has been getting boils, has been running a fever. They said, whoa, wait a minute. That was a major betrayal right there. It means something for nations to have some kind of homogenous culture and unified glue that keeps the people together. That's the English language. That's Anglo-Saxon culture. It's a belief in capitalism and moving forward as individuals. And what you have now from 1965 is you're letting them in. Fear of a brown planet is what I'm talking about right now. From that point in time, you saw conservatives really starting to get itchy about what had happened as a matter of policy in terms of immigration. Patrick Buchanan, running for president, spoke to a group of people who he knew were conservative and would support him. He said, look, I don't have to go into a long diatribe with you. I'm just going to ask you one question right now. Who do you want coming into your county tomorrow? If I let 100 people come into the county of Sacramento tomorrow, 100, do you want 100 Englishmen or 100 Zulus? And everybody in the room, yeah, Pat, we understand what you're talking about right now, right? The transformation of the United States becoming more diverse is an alarm bell for many people who are saying this is the end of our country as we know it. Muriel, I see your hand.
Hiring personal family service and stuff. Is there any data on the politics of that? I mean, do conservative people not hire personal service? I mean, is there any indication?
No, I can't point you to any specific source, but I can tell you getting servants is universal. Meaning you can find liberals, moderates, and conservatives wanting people that will clean their toilets and change their beds and watch their babies. I mean, so one of the ironies, if you remember the Clinton administration, there were a couple of appointees. I'm trying to remember their names, and I can't.
Lonnie
Guinier. There we go. Not Lonnie Guinier. It was
Zoe Baird.
Kimball Woods. Who were examples of just like stone cold liberals, but when it turned out that they, you know, had undocumented watching their kids. I mean, it's just the phenomena that you see. There's one other example I wanted to give you. Lots of displaced Salvadoran women, displaced because of the civil wars, the Reagan-inspired civil wars in Central America. Many of those women came over to the United States and became nannies, became very, very important in the lives of lawyers and corporate executives in the United States, especially places like Washington, D.C. Repeating the question, how do you explain the contradictions of conservatives who are supposed to be against undocumented people but then will hire those people? And I think it's basically, if you hire an American to watch your kids, they're going to want $10 an hour, and you can probably get a Salvadoran who will do it for three. Yeah? I mean, that's the way I would answer that question. I want to move through these because there's still a bunch to go. Refugee Act. I mean, there's a number of refugee acts. The basic idea is that around the world, there are people that are displaced because the militia or the government is literally coming into your town to kill everybody. I spoke to a group of leaders from Guatemala many years ago. It was a group about this big. And they were all mayors and city council members and on the board of education in their various towns in Guatemala. And I said, I'm just curious, how many of you have had any kind of contact with violence by the military or against your people? And 90% of the people in the room raised their hands. And I said, what do you mean? And one after another, they found my sister's head on the edge of town. They skinned my brother alive. They burned down half of the town. I mean, that's what I was getting from these people. So the key phrase here is a well-founded fear of persecution. The military has a convoy. They're coming to our town. They're going to kill all the Indians. And you just see 100 people start running, trying to get away. Now, that leads to internal displacement that I've talked about before, but it also leads to people attempting to get out of the country and hopefully come to the United States or some other nation. In the 1980s, there was a sanctuary movement in this country. I'm happy to say that in Sacramento, there was also a successful resolution before the city council to get sanctuary. It just basically meant people that are fleeing that kind of persecution should not be persecuted and hounded. You should do the same thing that the church would do, which would be to provide some kind of sanctuary. In 1986 is another very important act. I refer to it as IRCA, which is the acronym for a much longer thing. IRCA is not a killer whale. IRCA had two really important provisions. One was an employer sanctions provision, meaning that employers were not supposed to hire undocumented people, and if they did, they could get in trouble. They could be fined, possibly go to jail. And the second one was it allowed a number of undocumented people to become legalized in this country. Many conservatives were very, very angry, especially about the amnesty provision.
Eric,
yes.
I noticed this. Is that the one that was Simpson was holding?
Yes. 1990s, I told you about Operation Gatekeeper and the militarization of the border. Proposition 187 is there. But Clinton administration was also responsible for the Illegal Immigrant Responsibility Act, and that led to expanding the grounds for detention, deportation, and severely limiting public assistance. 9/11, now you toss in national security and the paranoia and, you know, just the really scared of the, you know, the world is after us, there's terrorists and we're at war and we need to deal with this issue. So what you saw was, as an example, Operation Tarmac. Around the country, you started seeing people who worked at the airports no longer having their jobs. So lots of people lost their jobs as a result of that. You also saw special registration. What this means is that specifically Arab, Muslim, Southeast Asian people were targeted. You better come in and register with us. So the figures here are approximately 84,000 people, of which approximately 14,000 went into deportation hearings. We don't know the full story about this. I want to be clear about that. To this day, we still don't know who was taken away and where they are at and what happened to them. Okay? So this is in the aftermath of 9/11. In 2005, you have the Real ID Act. I don't know the details on this, but basically the idea is that they are pushing for a national identification form or license. In 2005 and 2006, you saw the House Resolution 4437. The Republicans in Congress basically said we must send a message that we're going to be really tough on immigration. Not a little bit tough, real tough. We are going to criminalize their butts. And we're going to gain the American public's support around this tough stance, this law enforcement stance. The response was massive demonstrations, unparalleled, the largest demonstrations in the Latino community probably in the history of this country, all around the country. I mean, and I was at some of them, and, you know, the basic idea was my aunt, my grandmother, my uncle, that's who they're talking about. And they're not bad people. They're not criminals. They're hardworking people. How dare they be so mean to us? That was the kind of the feeling that I got from massive opposition that developed. And finally, we are in this period of time that I've referred to as the restrictive period of time, and at a minimum, 182 anti-immigrant bills passed in some 43 states. So this all over the place. I mean, city councils, board of supervisors, board of educations are passing these laws that say you'll go to jail if you allow an undocumented to rent your apartment. You, taxi driver, if you give an undocumented and you know they're undocumented, you can get fined. Right? In some parts of the country, like Oklahoma, there have been significant, you know, numbers of people, I mean, large numbers of people that leave the town. You know, one day it's a thriving economy, and the next day, you know, 172 people undocumented have left town, and just an important part of your economic base is gone. Glenn?
Just to be clear on House Resolution 447, now that's something that was censored better than back in that.
Yes.
That never became law.
No. So I was going to talk about it just a second, but Glenn is absolutely on point. So this massive opposition occurred from the Latino community and its allies in this country, and the Republicans were not able to put together enough force to push their bill through. There's a couple of angles on this. What's happened is that in the pro-immigrant community, there's major splits that I will talk about in my concluding comments. But on the Republican side, there's major splits as well. The splits go something like this. President Bush, you might think of as a liberal on this issue, so to speak. His angle is, I want to connect employers with potential workers, right? I want comprehensive immigration reform. I'm open and willing to listen to guest worker programs and some kind of amnesty program. I'm willing to listen to that. The other part of the Republican Party is just like, if you've ever seen a werewolf, They are very, very angry. What they want is the most draconian, tough law enforcement approach. Put them in jail, kick them out. What's the debate here? They're violating our laws. They're not supposed to be here. What's wrong with you if you don't understand that they need to be out? So that's the split within the Republican Party. I mean, it's much more complex than that, but that's essentially what's going on in their split. Okay, so that's a real quick look at important immigration laws. Okay, what is the conservative critique? I want to just try to articulate that. And there's a couple of authors, if you want to take a look at this. Patrick Buchanan has written books on immigration, as has another guy by the name of Peter Brimelow, an English author. There is real concern that our country cannot assimilate these people, so that we are under threat of cultural extinction. I mean, that's sincerely like a real concern. There is a concern that the rule of law is being undermined. And if you don't have the rule of law, then everything is chaos. There is a concern regarding national security. You cannot trust these people. You don't know how many of them may be terrorists or may not care about the United States. Brimelow also includes, in one of his books, also includes a concern. The Democratic Party is the party of minorities. And so they're going to recruit amongst this group of people. They are the racist party. Okay, so that's one of the arguments that he's concerned about. What is another critique? Another critique would be they are really beneficial for the United States of America. They create jobs, they create businesses, they do the jobs that other people don't want to do in this country. They do not take away from the economic base of this country in terms of benefits. They pay into taxes, they are rescuing Social Security. Everybody understand what I'm saying? So this critique says, no, there's some really good positive things about having immigrants in this nation, both legal and undocumented.
What kind of citizens are they? Are they informed? Do they learn about our
country? I'll just give you one example, because a lot of people are under the impression that Mexican immigrants, as an example, don't want to learn English. But all of the studies, including a recent Pew Hispanic Center study, indicates that the cohorts of Mexican immigrants in this country follow the same pattern as all other immigrants. By the second generation, they speak English. That's what you see.
Second generation is bilingual.
They're bilingual. By the third generation, English monolingual. But by the second generation, they're already speaking English. I want to end by... And they do participate. So I gave an example earlier of the massive numbers of Latinos that are moving through the naturalization process, citizenship, registering to vote, and the Democratic and Republican parties are right now got their eye on the Latino voting population, because different than in the past, they want to get involved. They want to participate. Yeah? I told you about the split on the pro-immigrant side. I want to be real clear. This is a split that is occurring in the advocacy organizations, in the churches, in the labor unions. Here's what the split is about. One part of comprehensive immigration reform that you are going to see floated in this country will include something like a guest worker program. And the split is largely a guest worker program is one more way in which you separate citizens from second-class people that are still going to be exploited economically and socially. Yeah? So that'll lead to this critique that I'll finish my comments on in a moment. And I've already told you about the split within the conservative movement. They are not doing too well, because the polling data indicates that the American public, while they get riled up around the issue of undocumented workers in this country, they also have kind of a pragmatic, can't we just figure out a way of solving this thing? You know, like, let's just solve it. Let's not just kick them all out. Let's solve it. Let's have some kind of an amnesty program to allow these people to adjust their status. All right. I wanted to end by talking about what I think is a new paradigm. I wanted to talk about the European Union. In Europe, you may know that a number of the nations are connected to each other. In other words, they've taken down their border patrols. They don't have militarized borders. You can just cross from one nation to another nation, and nobody's going to even ask you for a passport. They're not going to ask you for your papers. Is everybody with me? Now, some people would say, oh my God, when Spain is allowed in, when Portugal is allowed, when Italy is allowed, when Greece is allowed, there will be, our borders will be overflowing with those Portuguese and those Greeks trying to come into Germany and France, the advanced European nations, right? It didn't happen. You know what happened? There were a number of people that came from Greece and Italy and Portugal and Spain, and there was a whole bunch of Englishmen that went down to Spain and Portugal and Italy and Greece. What you saw was the movement of peoples. Why would seniors want to move to Greece or to Spain?
It's their Florida.
It's their Florida. What you saw was a decline in unemployment levels. What you saw was an increase in job creation on both sides. Poland, incredibly, Poland is really moving forward right now. Greece is moving forward. All of the nations are benefiting. If you ask the voting public in Europe, what are they most proud of? They are proud of the integration of Europe in terms of not having to show your papers and crossing borders and learning about other peoples and getting a job. Having said that, that model is internal to the European nations, because what did I say earlier? African people are drowning in the Mediterranean. All right. I think we are at an interesting point in time in which we need to rethink this entire issue of immigration. In the 21st century, we need to figure it out. And I think what we are pitting is the old emphasis on civil rights, which are closely related to citizenship and national constitutions, with a deeper and more important framework of human rights. That all human beings on the planet Earth, if we are to look at ourselves in the mirror and say we have any kind of morality, they are human beings that have rights. Yeah? So in the handout, I gave you some examples of what that means. I think rather than reforming immigration, we need to abolish the idea of illegal aliens. Abolitionism should be on the strategic menu of what we are doing. I think we need to get away from U.S.-centered nationalism and see that the problems of the planet Earth in the 21st century are interconnected, global, and transnational. That's the period of time that we are in. And instead of focusing historically, as we have, on race and ethnicity associated with the nation, I think we need to see intersectionally, meaning we need to see sexism, racism, homophobia, and the interconnections of class with all of those, and disability. We need to have a, what's the word, gestalt? We need to bring them all together. So I think there's a new paradigm that is emerging. I believe in a saying that some Africans have said, we are here in Europe because you were there. Yeah? The U.S. out of North America. Right? We need to rethink the negative implications of nationhood, and we need to think morally about the implications of separating citizenship from other human beings. I'll just end by saying that slavery was not reformed. It was abolished. And that we are on the threshold in the 21st century where we need to have a move forward with a transnational social justice agenda. Thank you very much. Well, I have questions.
You mentioned the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And I think they're perhaps one of the worst examples of bad behavior in the world today. Well, we should be setting examples of good behavior. And I wonder, is anything being done to limit the predations of these two, of this monetary fund and the bank?
I would refer all of you to a book called Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein. It's a very interesting book, and she talks about how in periods of dislocation and hurricanes, earthquakes, coup d'etats, what happened was that the Chicago School of laissez-faire economics, in other words, radical capitalism, was imposed in various countries around the world.
Shock Doctrine.
Shock Doctrine.
Naomi Klein.
And But on the other hand, what you're seeing as an example in South America is that a number of the nations there are repudiating that right-wing school of economics. That's what's happening right now. And you can see that by way of the work of Evo Morales in Bolivia, of Kirchner in Argentina, in Lula in Brazil, in Chavez in Venezuela. There is a repudiation of exactly what you're talking about right now. It's called the fight against neoliberalism. The fight against neoliberalism. I want to just give you one real quick example of what I'm talking about. In Cochabamba, Bolivia, the corporations came in and said, we think what you need to do is start marketing water. You need to sell water. Privatize is the name of the future. And the people of Cochabamba said, but we've been drinking water because it falls from the heavens. And we're poor people. What are you talking about buying water? And so they took out tires and they went to the streets and people died. But they repudiated, they did not allow them to complete the privatization of water in Cochabamba. It's a very interesting example of something that I think is happening around the rest of the Americas. There's also a major confrontation occurring in Mexico right now, if any of you have been following that. And it has to do with oil and Mexico being able to hold on and have sovereignty over its oil for the benefit of the Mexican people.
What's driving people is economic insecurity, and that's the same thing that generates the backlash. So really, we have to deal with economic insecurity, and we have to deal with, you know, it in a way that also gives ecological security.
So in Mexico right now, there is a growing movement that one of the centers of their argument is that we want the right not to have to immigrate. And around the world, people would say, you know what, if I had my brothers, I'd rather stay here in my town. But the problem is, I can't feed my kids. And I'll look at anybody in the eye who has kids, and I'll tell you, we're going to try to go whether across a river, a mountain, a desert to feed our kids. That's the fact. So it goes back to what you were saying. What has to happen is internationally you have to address the root problem of why people are being dislocated, why they're losing their jobs, why there's not economic development, who's profiting, who isn't. And when you start confronting those issues, you might see a lessening in this movement of people that impacts the environment. Somebody else, back of the room.
Are you hopeful that there'll be a change on this hardcore enforcement when Bush leaves office? Do you think that's going to change?
I look forward to helping to create a mass movement centered around international human rights. That's what I can believe in. I'm pessimistic because I think conservatism has got a strong hold on the mindset of many in the United States. And they see undocumented people as the enemy, as illegals. The very way in which those people are constructed as illegals sets in motion a whole series of policies that are going to make it very difficult for reform. So I think ultimately what will happen is probably some wimpy Bush approach to solving immigration and comprehensive immigration reform. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a paradigm shift, but I think that's much deeper and much more difficult.
Thank you, Eric Vega, and thank you in the audience for listening to Great Speeches and Interviews.